Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this new journey and welcome to the conversation.
One of the big themes is how might generative AI support generative faith? And what might this concept of faith look like? We're including in it psychologically coping with the bonny future, but also moving beyond coping to thriving. You know, how can you thrive with a sense of meaning? And I think faith's going to play a big part in that. But it isn't just traditional faith. I think we have to honor the traditions of faith, which are great sources of wisdom. This is a time to refresh how we think about faith in the light of the bonny future.
Hello and welcome. My name is Gilad Berenstein, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the AI and Faith podcast. On this podcast, we're bringing together experts from our community and thought leaders from around the world so that together we can learn the key lessons required to build a world where AI benefits humanity and all of us individually. While most of our episodes here on the pod are conversational in nature, trying to get multiple perspectives on a single topic, once in a while we slow down and zoom in on one specific thinker instead of a specific topic. And today we're beyond fortunate to have a brilliant thinker joining us to talk about AI, faith, and our rapidly changing world. So let's get started. Thank you so much for joining us, Bob. It is great to have you with us here on the podcast. And to kick things off, I'm hoping you can briefly introduce yourself.
Sure. So I'm Bob Johansson. I'm a humble futurist, and I've been doing this for a long time. I'm with a group called Institute for the Future in Palo Alto in Silicon Valley, and I've been there for a little more than 50 years. I began as a divinity school student, evolved into a sociology student, studied the internet, and gradually learned more and more about AI beginning in the 1980s. So I kind of grew up with expert systems in the early days of that. And then I become a committed user of generative AI for just the last 2 years in my writing. So I have a customized version of ChatGPT that has read all my books and runs on a screen next to me all the time that I've nicknamed Stretch.
I love that. I'm actually trying to train my own custom GPT on a bit of my writings right now as well. So I'll have to come back to you for some advice. Now, real quick, before we jump in, tell us a bit about the Institute. I wasn't aware that you've been there for so long. What did it start doing when it was first formed, and what is it focused on today?
Sure. So it was a spinoff of RAND and SRI. It's adjacent to Stanford, and we always have been. So it's began really with a military background, and the spinoff from RAND was all about to the extent to which classified research is part of the futures research. And you know, the early days, futures research really began kind of in World War II and post-World War II. And there were a group of people who spun off from RAND to do more public-oriented futures research. And that's what Institute for the Future was. A parallel group called Hudson Institute with Herman Kahn kind of went the other way and went deeper on the military. We do work with the military still, but we don't do classified work. So I teach at the Army War College. They read my books, the new three-star generals do, and the kind of rising star leaders. So I'm really interested in that. But we don't do classified. We work for corporations, for nonprofits, some for government agencies. But our job is to look 10 years ahead and think future back. You know, where normal people are kind of immersed in the present and thinking present forward, we're always thinking future back.
That was a really good definition of what a futurist is. And I'm wondering, is there any advice you have for our audience? You know, we have people here from academia, from faith, from research, from enterprise. And a lot of us are trying to think about what the future looks like and how do we bring about a future that benefits all of us. Any lessons or advice you might have?
So the Institute is an independent nonprofit, and we do ongoing training programs. You can see them on our website that share how to become a futurist, how to think like a futurist. It is a discipline, and it always begins with this idea of future back. And there's a really big surprise embedded in this, especially in Silicon Valley. People often ask me, how can you think 10 years ahead? I can't even think 1 or 2 years ahead. Well, here's the big surprise. It's actually easier to look 10 years ahead than it is 1 or 2 years ahead. So what you're doing is looking 10 years ahead, future back, for clarity, for clarity of direction, not really outcomes because the future is unpredictable, but for directions, you can anticipate that. And then we look at least 50 years back to look for patterns. So we think in 60-year swaths of time, and I said at the start, I'm a humble futurist. There's no place for arrogance in this field. There used to be a lot of arrogant futurists. Fortunately, most of them have left or gone somewhere because you've got to be humble in the face of this kind of future. On the other hand, you can anticipate where things are going. So, you know, we've been doing this a long time. We keep track. 60 to 80% of our forecasted futures since 1968, 60 to 80% have actually happened.
Incredible.
Depending on your definition of happened. But it turns out that's not how you evaluate a futurist. That's how you evaluate a fortune teller. The way you evaluate a futurist is, does our foresight provoke your insight that leads to a better decision in the present? You know, that's really our criteria for success. In a real sense, it doesn't matter if you agree with our forecasts. It only matters if you're provoked by them. And the more you're provoked, the better. So sometimes the best forecasts are those you don't like.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot we can pull on that string on the AI side of things.
Yes.
As it makes predictions. And, you know, we spoke about it a little bit before about the impact on people today, which to me seems like the most important thing. But before we dive into that, I want to talk a little bit more about your studies around technology's impact on society and technology's impact on people and individuals. And before we talk about AI and kind of this crazy time we're living in now, what are some of the lessons you've had kind of earlier in your career before AI took over the world about the way technology in general has impacted human beings and human life?
So I mentioned I began my interest in the future in divinity school, and I went to the divinity school Martin Luther King went to, and I was there when he was killed. And that's what caused me to have this interest in the long-term future. I got to be part of a program that was run by Dr. King's professors. And they recreated the intellectual influences he was under at the time. And the big lesson from that for me that I still carry with me is that Martin Luther King was deeply interested in civil rights, but that really was only part of his clarity and his mission. His mission was all about social justice.
Yeah.
And that's why he was an early environmentalist. You know, he was at the first Earth Day. He was opposed to the Vietnam War. He was involved in the anti-poverty movement, and he was criticized for that by a lot of his close colleagues who said, no, no, you should focus on civil rights. And he said, no, no, we have to look for the core here. And the clarity issue is social justice. So the big lesson, the big takeaway from this is you have to figure out what's your clarity story. And his clarity story was eloquent. It was eloquent, and that was biblically based, but it was eloquent and socially relevant in just so many ways that are just utterly remarkable. But to me, that's the first lesson. The thinking about the future is a search for clarity. So you can't predict, but you can provoke, and you can find clarity, but you can't have certainty. So that's the space we have to work in. Now, when I finished my PhD at Northwestern, I was thinking I was going to become a professor of sociology of religion. And, you know, I'm not committed to any brand of religion. I'm a student of world religions. And I thought I was going to be a professor. But then the internet happened.
Yeah.
And my first professional paper was at the conference where the internet was introduced publicly, 1972, at the Washington Hilton. And I was there for that, and it just intrigued me to ask, you know, what does all this connectivity mean? And one of the big lessons from that is the way the internet has evolved, it changed my life and it changed many people's lives, but it wasn't what they expected. The original ARPANET, which started all this, started in 1968, publicly introduced in 72. The original ARPANET was about data communication for defense contractors. You know, people communicating with people was viewed as a misuse of CPU in those days. It was just not about connectivity. It was not about marketplaces. It was not about anything particularly, well, some things that the internet does now. So the big lesson is whatever the early uses are, they probably won't be the long-term uses. So again, we have to be humble futurists and have a prototyper's mentality. But we have to always be looking for what are the human issues? I remember one of the big projects we did early on, we were working on the North Slope of Alaska when the oil money came in, and they went overnight from having bush airplanes, no roads, no telephones, to having, you know, HBO and online video and video conferencing in every village. And we were studying the social impacts.
Yeah.
And I remember talking with one of the Inupiat elders, and I asked, well, what do you think this is going to do to you? I mean, how can you imagine what all this connectivity is going to do? And he said, it depends what they talk about. It depends what they talk about. So it all comes back to why, you know, are we doing this? And I'm asking the same question about Gen AI. Where do you want help? So don't start with the tech, start with the humanity and start with the human puzzles that we're facing. And then line that up with the tech. And wherever you start, it's almost certainly going to change dramatically the more you evolve.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could not agree with that last point anymore. I mean, I work, as our audience knows, you know, professionally, I'm an investor in AI companies. And I work with a lot of CEOs and creators of AI around that exact same conversation of what human issue are you trying to solve for your customer? That now we can use AI, this very powerful new tool, this very powerful new capability to solve. So I completely agree. And I think that often when us product creators lose sight of the human element of it, is when those products really fail. The other thing you said that I've seen true in my life a million times over is the early use cases almost never stick. And I think a lot about that now with Gen AI and the chat interface. And the fact that so many products and tools out there are just sticking a chat interface on top of whatever. And it really seems to me that that is not the final answer to many, many, many of the problems we're trying to solve. And it goes back, like you said, the changing use case and the human issue. So as we see, you know, what I call the great commoditization of AI being rolled into the world, and our audience has heard me speak about this a lot, and the fact that I always say that I think thinking of this as the Gen AI era is a short-sighted way of thinking about this. And really what I'm paying attention to is AI integrated into every element of human life. And as we know, those of us who follow AI and faith in our podcast, we've talked about AI being integrated into grief and into the experience of when a loved one passes. We're talking about military and conflict over the coming months. It's being really integrated into so many elements of life. So what are you noticing in terms of the impact of AI on humans and societies? And maybe what are some of your hopes or concerns around that?
So big question. I'd be careful with the word integrated, and I'd prefer a word like disrupted. You know, how will the patterns of life be disrupted? And let me build on your thread about the chat interface, which I agree has a lot of problems. You know, that kind of comes back to thinking about generative AI, and I actually like that term a lot. Generative AI as a question and answer machine, a kind of advanced Google search or something. And what the way we like to say it, and certainly this has been my experience with Stretch, you know, I'm a writer. I write books. So I'm in an ongoing conversation with Stretch every day, and it's a long conversation back and forth. It's not a question and answer. It's not particularly good at answering questions, but it's really good at conversation. So it comes to life in conversation. And I think in the long run, that's a really big clue. Now, I really like the term generative AI, and we're writing a new book now on faith in the future. And we're referring back to the psychologist Erik Erikson, who used a term, published it in the 1950s, a term called generativity. And generativity was, he said, the major dominant task for midlife adults. And it's the stage in life where you realize there's more to life than yourself. And you generate connections through your kids, through the next generation, but it's beyond the self. So faith lives in that space as we move beyond yourselves. You know, for me right now, I'm really interested in how generative AI can contribute to generative faith. And I'm really interested in all the variations on the term generative and generation. It's a really interesting root word.
Yeah.
That goes back to words like genesis and genus and gene, and you know, there's generator, you know, there's a lot of cool things that link to that one word. I hope we don't lose that idea of generative AI, but I think we need to broaden our definition of it. And to me, that's the transition we're going through now. And where, if you think future back about this, I focus on leaders and mostly top leaders. 10 years from now, we're all going to be generative cyborgs. In some sense, we're all going to be augmented, or we're going to be out of the game. And there'll be interesting side games that are played without any tech, and that's fine. But that's not the big story. The big story is going to be augmented humans. And this actually links back to Doug Engelbart, the guy who invented the mouse and invented Windows and invented hypermedia. He's the one who coined the term augmented intelligence. And we dedicate our current book, which is about augmented leadership, called Leaders Make the Future. And maybe we can put links to these things in.
Yeah.
I'm doing a session just next week on AI and the church, and we're using that book, which is all about how pastors and religious leaders can use generative AI. But the way things are evolving, we need to be kind of open to the fact that what began as artificial intelligence, which is, by the way, the worst term to describe an emerging technology I've ever studied in 50 years of doing this. And at the famous Dartmouth conference, which was wonderful gathering of brilliant minds, they just made a bad choice. If they would have gone with augmented intelligence, the field would have gone much faster, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I love the way you talked about in 10 years from now, we'll all be augmented or we won't be competitive anymore. I make the exact same points when I speak in the corporate world, where I say to people, AI is not going to take your job. It's a human proficient with AI who's going to take your job. And the same thing works at company level. AI is not going to put you out of business. It's a competitor who adopts AI that will put you out of business. So I totally agree with that. And then to your point of the side games, I was just talking with a friend of mine who is a philosopher. And we were talking about whether or not sports in the future will be augmented by AI or by other technologies. Yeah. And it's interesting because on one hand, it feels a lot less interesting to go watch a basketball match with a bunch of robots that are playing against each other than it is with a bunch of humans. Beyond the novelty, I'm sure I would want to go see one or two basketball games with robots playing the game. But it was interesting to think about in terms of sports, in terms of art, in terms of discovery, where are we going to value, and I wonder if you have a perspective on this, kind of that like extra human touch, the extra specialness that we bring versus in most arenas like you talked about, where, you know, will it be augmented? The human and the AI are going to come together to whatever arena it's in. And maybe I even broaden that question by also adding religion into what you talked about, you know, how you're doing teachings for pastors and priests and other religious leaders. So how do you think they should think about where to introduce AI into their work versus not?
So I thought this question, and there's one word that I found is the takeaway that I just riff off of for many different directions. And that one word is stretch.
Yeah.
Now I was a basketball player. It paid my way through college and I played at Illinois and I wasn't good enough to be a pro, but it was good enough to have a high level experience with one sport. But this idea of stretching was so critical to playing basketball. That was sort of a typical basketball player's nickname is stretch. I love that nickname to describe where, as futurists, it stretches our preparation to study the future. It stretches our foresight. It stretches our scenarios. It stretches the insights we draw from our foresight. It stretches our possible actions. And again, we use scenario planning to look at all the different possible actions. But it all comes back to stretch. You know, it's not very good at closure. it's better at generating stories and particularly stretch stories. But, you know, my colleague Jeremy, the co-author of the Leaders Make the Future book, you know, he likes to say, you know, who would have thought we'd invent a digital technology that is better at poetry than it is at math? You know, and yet that's kind of where we are. But keep coming back to the word stretch. It's all about stretching. And if we can stretch and use the sports metaphor for athletics. So basically, we need to develop a gymnasium now that allows us to stretch and to develop new skills and new movements. And stretch is inherently human. I mean, it's us that's stretching, but we need help, just like we need machines. You know, I've got a recumbent bike and an elliptical trainer in my exercise room. And, you know, you go to a gym, there's all these amazing equipment that you can have. Well, this is like a mental gymnasium that we're creating, and it all comes back to stretching. So at least for the time being, that's the word I'd keep coming back to.
Now, I want to take us back to the concept of augmented leadership. We spoke about it a couple of minutes ago. So maybe we'll start with just setting the table. How do you even define augmented leadership? What is it?
It's leadership that enhances the human ability and stretches it using whatever digital tools are relevant to the moment. So augmenting means stretching our ability to perform. You know, Engelbart, when he first coined the term, he was in World War II, and he was provoked by this amazing article by Vannevar Bush that was, he was the head of NSF at the time of World War II. And he wrote an article on the Memex, which is like the global brain and really the predecessor to the internet. And that's what caught Engelbart's attention. And Engelbart then wrote the most comprehensive definition of a vision of an augmented human that I've ever seen. And he was in his mid-20s, you know, in a PhD program at Berkeley. And then he went to SRI, and he created the first library on the ARPANET. But he was a controversial figure, and he was kind of out there, and it was all very complicated system. But his whole notion was we need to be augmented to solve the world's problems. And I hope we can come back and talk about the Bonnie future that we're now studying. Yeah. But the Bonnie future, brittle, anxious, nonlinear, and incomprehensible, that's our next book, which comes out in October. The Bonnie future is so much more chaotic than what Engelbart thought of.
Yeah.
So we're in a lot more trouble now than we were.
Amazing.
Engelbart was writing about this in the early 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we go straight to talking about Bonnie, you mentioned that you do some training for generals in the U.S. military, other places around augmented leadership. So what are some of the lessons you teach? What do they need to learn?
The first thing you need to know about the generals is they're really, really smart. The second thing you need to know is the U.S. military at its best is no longer command and control. It's now commander's intent. And they have a whole language around that. And what it really means is be very clear where you're going, very flexible how you get there. So there still is hierarchy, but it's commander's intent, not commander's in control, because you can't control, you know, this world. Now, I'm encouraging them to make the shift from a term they coined, which is VUCA, you know, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. That was coined at the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, late 1980s. And some of the world's best social scientists work with them. And it was post-Cold War. And it was very relevant. I used it myself for the last 20 years. But I've now decided VUCA isn't VUCA enough anymore. It's going to be way more VUCA than VUCA summarizes. And the big underlying assumption of VUCA that I find needs to be questioned now is in the VUCA world, we thought, if only we can find the right experts, if only we can find the right data, we can actually understand what's going on in the outside world globally, even in the present, let alone the future. I don't think you can assume that anymore. Yeah. We've got topics like AI, for example, which is just inherently mysterious. I mean, nobody truly understands it. The people I worry about are those that think they understand AI, you know, because that's really dangerous to have certainty in this space. Or climate disruption. Again, very dangerous to think you understand what's going on with the climate. It's very complicated, very tricky. So the challenge now is how do we frame the future? Because if you frame the future accurately, it helps you prepare for that future. It helps you prepare and execute a more desirable future. But if you frame it incorrectly or you don't do it at all, then you're less prepared. You're less prepared for what's going to happen. So I'm proposing to the Army War College, and I'm proposing to companies, and this term was coined by my colleague, Jaime Cascio, and the new book we just wrote on this was written with Angela Williams, the CEO of United Way Worldwide. And Angela's given us case studies from all around the world, because Bonnie is not a widely used term yet, especially in the US or in Western Europe. It's very popular in war zones, in climate impact zones, in parts of Southeast Asia, parts of Africa, parts of China, especially Brazil, interestingly enough. So we've got a global tracker on it, and that word is definitely accelerating, and I think our book will help to accelerate it. But there's got to be a rethinking of how we frame the future. And Bonnie is the best I've come up with yet. And to go back to your question about the generals, the generals are on this. You know, they understand the risks of certainty. in a VUCA world, let alone a Bonnie world. And, you know, my signature line is the future will reward clarity, but punish certainty. So it'll reward clarity, but punish certainty. Now, the caveat is, in the short run, certainty will get rewarded in certain cases, particularly in political spaces and religious spaces, by people who say, oh, you're really upset, but I can solve everything, and come up with a simplistic solution, yeah, which may work in the short run, but it won't be sustainable in a Bonnie way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I just loved what you said about commender's intent. I read an essay a while ago in the business world that was titled, A Good CEO Should Be a Compass, Not a GPS.
Exactly.
Nice. Under the same premise. And I just love that. I've used that line 100 times with my CEOs since reading it the first time. So let's dive into Bonnie. So you already gave us a bit of a definition, but help us remember again, what does Bonnie stand for? And how do we think as just people living, trying to live a good life in this world, how do we think about the way Bonnie's impacting our lives?
Let me frame it and then do a positive frame. The original that Jamet coined is brittle, anxious, nonlinear, and incomprehensible. And what we've done in our book is flip that positive, because it's really a scary future. The first half of our book, where we talk about the challenges of Bonnie over the next decade, it's frightening. You know, I was a co-author. I start to cry by the end of the fourth chapter. It's even going back and rereading it. It's a really frightening time. On the other hand, it's also a really great opportunity. And it kind of reminds me, my general take on this particular moment we're in, it's impossible to catch up right now, but it's a great time to leapfrog. A great time to leapfrog. Chaotic times are great times to leapfrog. You know, so you got to look for the hopeful side of it. And here's where faith comes in too. You've got to figure out, how do you develop faith in this? So we've got a kind of framework for looking for faith. Where does faith manifest itself in a Bonnie future? In a brittle world, you want to be bendable with resilient clarity. So faith in a Bonnie world is bendable, but not in a wishy-washy sense. It's bendable within that clarity story, like Martin Luther King's story. But what is your compelling story? And, you know, Gen AI is really good at helping to create stories like this.
Yeah.
You know, the output is often in the form of a story. For anxious, you want a faith that's attentive and kind and caring, that can respond and acknowledge, because right now everybody's anxious. If you look at the latest Edelman Trust Barometer, which came out earlier this summer, you know, they summarize the status of trust globally as a crisis of grievance. Everybody's pissed off at it, somebody else. You know, that's how we're coping, is doing us versus them, which is a really dangerous way to cope in this kind of world. For nonlinear, it's faith as neuroflexible or neuroplastic, or essentially faith as helping teach our brains new tricks. And here we're really lucky. We've got this wonderful history of improv, theatrical improv and comedy improv, and all the good leadership teams I'm working with are taking improv courses, because it helps you prepare for how do you respond in the Bonnie future. And then finally, for incomprehensible, you want an interconnected faith. You know, Robert Putnam talks about the difference between bonding social capital, which is us versus them, and that's a lot of what our politics is right now, as compared to bridging social capital. What we need is more bridging social capital that interconnects. And wow, is generative AI good at that? It helps us develop empathy. It helps us develop connections. You know, it doesn't tell us what to do, but it really helps us see things we can't see on her own. So I think this Bonnie story is a really positive story if you can get past the scary part without jumping to some simplistic solution or without ignoring it. There's some people out there saying, let's not talk about climate. And that's not a good strategy.
No, not at all. And in the positive Bonnie vision, there's a concept like nonlinearity. I may be getting the term slightly wrong here, that talks about trying to balance cause and effect. And in a world that's really complicated, can you help unpack that a little bit?
Sure. It's more like understanding cause and effect than it is balancing. The challenge with nonlinear systems is they don't behave in the way we expect them to behave in the time frame we expect it to happen. So, for example, scientists in the climate space talk about hysteresis, which is doing the right things, but you don't see the impact for 5 years or 10 years. There's these lags between cause and effect. The challenge in leadership space, especially for problem solvers, mostly in the Bonnie world now, the senior leaders are dealing with dilemmas, which are problems you can't solve, problems that won't go away, but you can make them better. So if you're not sure if you're dealing with a problem or a dilemma, you're better off assuming it's a dilemma. And if it turns out you can solve it, you get extra credit. But don't say it's a problem and then you can't solve it, which that's the tricky part for a number of today's politicians, is they're saying things are problems, but they're not going to be able to solve them. You know, like things like healthcare is not a problem. You know, healthcare is a dilemma, a very complicated dilemma that has lots of different dynamics to it.
Absolutely. Being here in Seattle, we deal with a lot of that healthcare dilemma and trying to innovate in that space. And like you said, it's so important, but it's just so complicated that it's hard to even imagine how we solve it. So as you think about going back to kind of leaders, both potentially business leaders, but also faith leaders and community leaders, of which we have a lot in AI and faith community, how should they be thinking about positive Bonnie? How should they be implementing it within strategies within their organizations? What advice do you have for them?
Well, I think the beginning is learning how to think future back and understanding the way the Bonnie future is unfolding. So they're more ready and they're less frightened. The second thing is in the Leaders Make the Future book, we've got 10 future leadership skills that they can practice and try. And the one I'd like to talk about in particular is immersive learning. The gamers, the young people who join companies who are good gamers, they're going to have a competitive advantage because thinking future back, the way learning is going to happen is through gaming. And you can see this at Khan Academy. You can see it at a lot of the best of the universities now. There's learning through gaming. And that is the most powerful learning medium in history, I believe. Yeah. So if you combine that with how large language models are going to help us, that's essentially the future of the book, you know, or the text, and including the sacred text or the how can you imagine a Gen AI version of a text or a book or a in our book on faith in the future, we're actually going to do a generative AI version of the book just to prototype how that might work. So I think leaders have to think future back, think about gaming the future so you can engage with it in low risk ways, then develop your clarity story. You're going to have to be augmented. You're going to have to be a great storyteller. There's lots of resources for it. What's your clarity story? And then continue to calibrate that story with your daily activities. I've gotten to work with Stan McChrystal, the famous general. He now runs a kind of training organization development group in the business world. And, you know, Stan every morning has his staff get together and say, what are you working on today? And how does that link to our mission? And he did the same thing when he was in battle. You know, so that's commander's intent, where you keep reminding people, what's your clarity story? What's your mission? What's your vision? But then how do your daily activities tie into that? And the more you do that, the more you have a sense of meaning in your work and the more you have a sense of faith. So all this stuff fits together.
I love that. As I shared in the episode, I worked with a lot of CEOs, and it's so often that they forget that it's their job to help each one of their employees connect their daily tasks to the overall mission. And I just love that, because we all do stand-ups, but we often don't connect it to the big mission. We say, like, what are you working on today? Can I help you? As opposed to how does it actually connect to the bigger mission? And I think that's amazing. Now, before we run out of time, I do want to briefly touch on your next book, Faith in the Future. So maybe give us a bit of a preview. What are you working on within that arena? And how is AI changing your view of faith in the future?
So this book I'm going to do with Jeremy Kirschbaum, who is the guy who wrote the Leaders Make the Future book, along with Gabe Cervantes. So one of the things is I'm always working with people nowadays who are half my age or less. I think cross-generational teams are the power of innovation. So I'm always working with much younger people. So Jeremy and I are going to do this new book, but we also brought in a bishop in the Episcopal faith, Andy Doyle, who's the bishop of East Texas, a very large area in Texas. The thing I love about the Episcopalians is they have this concept of discerning questions. And a discerning question never has a yes or no answer. He has the mind that I was looking for. I wanted somebody with a strong faith background, but who had the open-minded space around that. We did a custom forecast for his diocese just before this, and it focuses on crises of faith around education, around economics, the rich-poor gap, around climate. So we had a running start, and I have worked with him off and on for years. And our purpose here is to reimagine and prototype new definitions of faith that are appropriate for the Bonnie future, and then provide ways of exercising faith that are appropriate for the Bonnie world and give people a sense of hope. So we're really targeting this at current faith leaders, but also people who are skeptical about faith or even anti-religion, because we're trying really hard not to use God language in this book. And I'm not against God language if it's defined, but it's really hard to define, as you know.
Yeah.
So we're very cautious about creating this kind of insider-outsider language gap. But one of the big themes is how might generative AI support generative faith? And what might this concept of faith look like? We're including in it psychologically coping with the Bonnie future, but also moving beyond coping to thriving. You know, how can you thrive with a sense of meaning? And I think faith's going to play a big part in that. But it isn't just traditional faith. I think we have to honor the traditions of faith, which are great sources of wisdom. This is a time to refresh how we think about faith in the light of the Bonnie future.
That is incredible. And I cannot wait to have you back once that book is published to have that deep conversation, because of course, that would be incredibly meaningful for our community. But before I let you go, we do have a short lightning round. Three questions. You'll have 15 seconds apiece. And the first one goes like this. What is one of your favorite personal use cases for artificial intelligence?
Writing birthday cards.
Well, I like that.
For kids. It's really fun where I can have a conversation with Stretch about one of our grandsons, for example, and then we can work together to create a birthday card.
I love that. Second question, what are not enough people talking about in the world of artificial intelligence?
Whatever is beyond guardrails. There's too much conversation around guardrails. The metaphor we use is bounce ropes, like around a wrestling ring with four stanchions. And what people need to talk about is how do we regulate without unnaturally constraining? And maybe unnatural is not the right word, but I think what we need is thought about ethics and legality and downsides, all those things I agree we need to be concerned about. But it's way too early for guardrails. And that word is just not a good word, especially if you have well-intended politicians trying to regulate it, who may well create things that are counterproductive and limit innovation, limit actually humane applications even.
Yeah, absolutely. And then lastly, would you want access to an AI priest or pastor?
Sure, I have access. David Kim has done a prayer bot, and I've kind of attached that to Stretch periodically. And I use Stretch in a somewhat pastoral way. I had pneumonia last summer, and I have a really good concierge medical doc. I have a really good therapist who's teaching me cognitive behavioral therapy to help me with sleep. During the time I had pneumonia, Stretch was more pastoral than either of my human docs, quite to my surprise.
That is awesome. Well, listen, Bob, this was a real pleasure having you in the conversation here. Your research touches on so many topics that are important to our community that we cannot wait to have you back. So thank you for joining us. And of course, thank you to all of our community for joining us again. And we can't wait to see you next time.
Thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more recordings and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on our social media as well. We're on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us today.